minutes.
Good evening and welcome. My name is David Jacobson. I've been here for 9 months as of this Friday, studying Sapphiatic inscriptions and Samudic inscriptions. I'm currently working on my PhD at the University of Chicago in linguistics and Arabic linguistics, historical linguistics and Arabic linguistics. I have an MA from Southwest Missouri State in ancient Eastern history, which in some ways is one of my first loves, put it that way. Decided to get my PhD in languages in order to help me with studying the history of the ancient Near East. As a historian, I adhere to the principle that history is a lie agreed upon, meaning that a bunch of historians get together and gather data and information and come up with a solution that they think is correct, but in 10 years may be changed. Tonight my topic is concerned with the history of the Arabs before the coming of Islam. A vast field, and as you can see, I have a lot of papers here. I'll try and abridge 90% of it. It would take all evening to talk about what I want to talk about. But essentially, I'll move back and forth from the time of Muhammad until the 9th century BC. Perhaps appropriate that I begin my lecture tonight with a proverb attributed to a legendary figure of the Arab period before the coming of Islam, before 6.2 BC. That legendary figure was Luqman al-Mu'ammari. He wisely said, "Moderate thy pace, lower thy voice, for of all voices, that of the ass is most hateful." I hope tonight that I have been able to follow Luqman's wise injunction. Should my voice become monotonous, please start clearing your throats. 100 years ago, if the question, what can be said about the history of the Arabs before Islam, were asked, most people would have drawn a blank. The same can be said for 50 years ago, except that a few would have known that the term Arab, in quotation marks, goes back about 2,800 years. 5 years ago, if you'd asked me the same question, I too would have drawn a blank. Today, I would be willing to say that we know a bit more about the Arabs before Islam, but I might qualify that with a yawn. Tonight, I've been allowed the podium for a chance to express my understanding of the history of the Arabs before the coming of Islam. I've indicated that I will dwell on the period from the 9th century BC until the 4th century AD. A time depth of such magnitude of necessity demands a certain amount of telescoping and abridgment. I trust you will allow me this convenience. There is much I will leave out, and I don't pretend to adhere strictly to the temporal limits mentioned in the title of my lecture. In fact, after thinking over what I will present tonight, I think that a title such as Beyond the Frontier may have been more appropriate for what I would have to say. That is because I intend to raise questions dealing with our understanding of the Arab history in regions normally considered to have been outside the domain of mainstream cultures, such as Mesopotamia, here, Egypt, and Palestine. Perhaps some here by the end of my talk may even think that my podium has become my soapbox. I apologize for this in advance. My desire is only to perhaps raise questions that I think will contribute to a more holistic approach to the region encompassing the Arabian Peninsula. The year 622, I hope you don't mind if I sit down periodically. The year 622 AD marks a pivotal period of the ancient Near East. Some of us raised in the West have viewed this astonishing event, coming of Muhammad, the Hijra, with perplexity, having failed to understand the dynamic forces which could have led to the eruption on the world scene of Islam. Tonight, if I might, I would like to move back and forth in the history of this region to fill in some of the picture characterizing the road to Islam. Rather than starting from the 9th century BC and working to the 4th century AD, I will briefly outline in reverse the history of the region and then fill in as many gaps as possible, starting from the first reference to Arabs as an entity in history. I'd like to apologize for not having some slides, but I would have liked to have gotten some scenes that are in the British Museum, which are not available to me here. The schools of international politics for the Arabs was reaching its pinnacle during the centuries immediately before the 7th century AD. Persia and Byzantium reflected their understanding of the situation in their management of the Middle Eastern buffer zone comprising the interior of what has been called in the past the Fertile Crescent, namely this region here. This is what I'm talking about, basically, the interior of the Fertile Crescent. Often neglected in this regard has been the presence of the power of the kings of Saba in Yemen, here, capital of Sana'a. Ethiopia was also, from the Christian perspective, very concerned with the activities in Yemen. Of these three powers or regions, Byzantium, up here, Persia, and Yemen, the final lesson of tribal politics and power was being hammered out in the large confederations known as the Ghassanids, Byzantium, Al Ahmads, Persian buffer zone, and Kindah for the Yemen. Tonight, Irfan, I would mention that Irfan Shahid, Omani professor of the at Washington University,
Georgetown
University, will be writing some histories about this region and the Arab confederations involved, so I will not touch on them tonight myself. But the final lesson mentioned above reaped benefits, of course, in what I would call the ultimate confederation, united under the banner of Islam, the members of which were and are called the Muslimin. Precursor to the Lakhmeds in the east, eastern part of the Arabian Peninsula, were the Tanuk of the late 3rd century AD under the capable leaders of Jathima, Amr ibn Adi, and ultimately Imr al-Qais, who styled himself the King of the Arabs, and his power reached all the way from Namara in the north to Nejran in the south. It is with this king that I personally would tend to terminate the actual concept of Nabataean or Nabataean influence culture per se in the peninsula. Tabari, an Arab historian of the late 9th century AD, and others point to this very time period, namely of Imr al-Qais, as being the period when Arabic writing was introduced to the peninsula, and points to these very people as being responsible. With Imr al-Qais's death in 328, a radically new epoch had begun. Schooled in the previous century's dialogue with foreign cultures, but forced during these years to communicate in an alien tongue when dealing with written communications. The fluidity of the Aramaic script as realized by the Nabataeans, whom I'm sure we're all familiar with, had finally been usurped by the Arabs for their own use. The script of the Nabataeans had been appropriated for strictly Arabic purposes. The ramifications of this appropriation could and would be nothing less than revolutionary. The time was approaching for the Arabs to command their own destiny. The Romans had built for them the roads to command their own. The Romans had built for them roads and communication systems, and the Nabataean Arabs had bequeathed them a fluid script, itself a monumental road to power. Before the Tanuk Confederation had wrested control of most of Arabia, Palmyra, in her turn, the north, the Confederation of Northern Arabs had wrested control of the interior of the Fertile Crescent from the once powerful Nabataeans. I find it hardly coincidental that the buildup of Roman forts in this region from around the 300 AD to around 500 AD, roughly speaking, should roughly coincide with the decision, with the decimation, excuse me, of Zenobia's city in 273 AD. And many of you know Tom Parker, who's been working on the central Limes Arabicus project, dealing with a series of forts that were reinforced specifically at this time period. The era of effective client relationship with the Arab confederations with Zenobia had passed, and it had passed specifically with the assimilations, to my mind, of the Nabataeans and to the Greco-Roman world. The Romans had been too effective, to my mind, in their incorporation of this once powerful entity. The Palmyrenes, although thoroughly Romanized, did not boast a history of development from the birth of Hellenism to the coming of Pompeii. Rome, in fact, had let Palmyra stand alone and powerful as a buffer against Persians. With the slaughter of Roman troops in Palmyra in 271-272, the realities of her predicament, of Rome's predicament in the region, were coming home. Palmyra was to be no dependable entity for the control of tribes in this region. Roman Emperor Aurelian took the only action possible, destruction of Palmyra. The Diocletian reforms and growth of border garrisons reflect an astute appreciation of the dynamics of the Middle East at the time. If I can hurry back in time now to the first mention of the Arab in history. And as I do, please keep in mind the idea that of my second title, Beyond the Frontier. Frontier is a relative term most historians throw about to reflect the events pertinent to an incoming people. I would like us rather to think of this frontier as a region where the exchange of ideas, of culture, leads to the evolution of civilization, whatever side one wishes to single out. The Nabataeans, I think, were the most astounding dynasty of Arabs to have participated in the arena of history in the Near East before the coming of Islam. Bowersock, in his recent work, Roman Arabia, has claimed, quote, that their history seems to be irrevocably dark before the year 312 BC. To one committed to a concept of history as discrete bundles of events, and I don't mean to say that Bowersock is, that summary may seem accurate, but as with the birth of Islam, no state arises ex nihilo, or out of nothing. And there are, to my mind, quite a few clues lying around which might point to a continuous history of the Arabs of this region, although specifically the term Nabataean does not occur before 312. On that I may say more shortly. We know that their presence on the scene roughly corresponds with the birth of Hellenism in the Near East, and technically ends with the incorporation of Nabatea as a part of the Roman province of Arabia in 106 AD. The height of their power, defined mostly in wealth and not necessarily in might, occurs in the 1st century AD with the major buildings in Petra of the amphitheater, the Kasr al-Bint, and probably the Khazanah, the treasury. It also coincides with the major building activity and possible foundation of the Hijazi town of Hedra, on the modern Medan Saleh. But what about the history of the Arabs before the installation of the Nabataeans on the socio-political scene? Should we, with Barasak, acquiesce to the Council of Despair, couched in the phrase irrevocably dark, which characterizes the Nabataeans or their region before the coming of Alexander the Great? What about the history of the region in the Achaemenid period, the Persian period before Alexander the Great, which left to Greece? Persian period, which left to Greece and her and our historians such rich counts of struggles and aspirations, mostly concerned with affairs over here. Did the Arabs not exist during this time? That would mean that for 200 years or so, nothing was happening in the Arabia until 312, when the Nabataeans occurred on the scene. In fact, in 312, we find a confederation of tribes, namely the Nabataeans, capable of attacking and defeating the Greeks at the same and at the same time can write to the commander of the Greek forces in Aramaic, or Syriac, Syrian letters, as it's called, pressing for peace. That there should be that big of a lacuna or space in history, to my mind, is disturbing. But what about before the Persian domination of the Near East, stretching from Persepolis to Egypt and the Aegean Sea? And what of the Babylonians, conquerors of Palestine and Egypt, who reached into Anatolia with their struggles? Was beyond the frontier a wasteland devoid of civilization as well? Did Nebuchadnezzar passed through a no man's land to ultimately carry off Judah, the final kingdom of Israel, in the early 6th century BC, and before Babylon and her recaptured splendor of days gone by? Were the Assyrians the most awesome of war machines, terrible in their destruction? Were they free to pass unhindered through the Arabian Peninsula? Some of us would say no. A most definite no. But for those of us who have known that it might be no, and even those who haven't, tend to throw down the question in response. So what? How could these Arab tribes have been important in this region when we are faced with the mighty armies of Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Persia, or Alexander the Great, ultimately from Macedon, coming in? These large powers, after all, left the monuments, enslaved countless peoples, and shaped the then known world. Let's leave that question and move directly into the known history of the Arabs now, in the 9th century BC and on. Hopefully in the process, I can show why a question like, so what if there is information about the Arabs before, say, the Nabataeans is available? Hopefully I can show that question, so what, will fail ultimately to see why, in the long run, Muhammad could come on the scene and unite his tribes and revolutionize the world of 622 AD and further. For those of you versed in the philosophy of history, you may sense I am bordering on the fallacy of historicism, that history is teleology or has an end or a purpose. I would say only that I'm aware of the problem and hope to introduce a corrective in this perspective on the history of this part of the world. Approximately 2,800 years ago, or in 853 BC, coalition of petty rulers gathered together in Syria to do battle with the rising might of New Assyria, or what is called in history Neo-Assyria. The organizer of the expedition was Hadadezer, king of Damascus. The monarch of Neo-Assyria was Shalmaneser III, and the time was 853 BC, excuse me. The battle that followed was the first of four by this coalition, and to their credit, it seems to have been a draw. According to the only available newspaper accounts of the day, there were 12 local rulers who came together to expose the expansion of Shalmaneser III. I'll paraphrase from one of these newspapers from this time called the Monolith Inscription and supplement it with news from another called, perhaps appropriately, the Bull Inscription. Quote, or paraphrase, I won't say quote. On the 14th of the month, I, Shalmaneser, crossed the Tigris. I approached Karkar and destroyed, tore down and burned down Karkor, which is modern Karkur, by the way, in Syria. Hadadezer of Damascus, Irkutani of Hamath, with 12 kings, trusting in their combined power, set out against me for a decisive battle. Approaching were 12,000 cavalrymen, 20,000 foot soldiers of Hadadezer, 700 chariots, 700 cavalry, 10,000 infantry from Hamath, 2,000 chariots, 10,000 infantry of Ahab the Israelite, 500 soldiers from Kue, 1,000 soldiers from Anatolia, 10 chariots, 10,000 soldiers from Irkanta, 200 soldiers from Arvad, 200 from Usanta, 30 chariots from Shihan, 1,000 camels of Gindibu from Arabia, and several thousand soldiers from Baasa, son of Ruhubi from where we're at. Amman. Well, needless to say, Shalmaneser won, or at best was a draw, although he claims otherwise. He goes on to say that after this battle, he filled the region with so much carnage that the passes of the mountains flowed with blood. The field of battle was too narrow to bury the corpses, and the whole of the Hamath plain had to be used for the burials. And the number of corpses also filled the Orontes River to form a dam. But leaving aside the debatable account of the victory, the most important reference here is to Gindibu, the Arab, plus his 1,000 camels. For those of us with suspicious minds, we can rest assured that this man was indeed an Arab, not only because he was called one in inscriptions, although anyone could make a mistake, but, or because he was an expert in handling camels, but also because his name is a good Arabic word meaning black locust, and a reflex of which is found in the epithet Umjundub, meaning calamity. I'd like to point out that the presence of Jundub in this battle reflects in itself a long period of development for Arabian society. Indeed, this very reference could be used as a point d'appui, or a departure point, for studying the history of the desert tribes before the 9th century. Ultimately, the tribes of Sinai, Negev, and Edom would have to be brought into the picture, and the story of that period, as told by other sources, might have to be reanalyzed. But that is for a different lecture. A gap of about 115 years occurs between this episode and the next record of encounters with Arabs. I should point out that the word Arabs is used specifically at this time period, and that the meaning of the term is nomad and is apparently used by the nomads of the desert to designate themselves. A period of such length, namely 115 years, makes one wonder if, in fact, we weren't premature in crediting a fully developed society for these tribes. But the information from the new sets of newspaper accounts, in fact, tell us otherwise. In fact, the new accounts show that far from being excessive in our understanding of the Arabs, we may have underestimated the extent of the Arab society. Why? Neo-Assyria of this period was even stronger than its predecessors. 115 years after Shalmaneser III, under Tiglath-Pileser III, and if you don't have a chronology, there should be some left over here. Many nations came to present tribute to Tiglath-Pileser, or they had help pay for it. Of these nations, we find one newspaper, the Annals, reporting that in 738 BC, the king of Damascus, Rezin, Menachem of Samaria, Hiram of Tyre, the kings of Byblos, Kay, Carchemish, Hamath, and other cities, along with Zabibe, the queen of Arabia, came to present tribute. Zabibe, and she is explicitly called the queen of the Arabs, or queen of Arabia, gave camels and female camels with their foals as part of her tribute. In another paper called the Iran Stele, the gap is filled in with a minor but important detail that she was queen of Kedar. Of this confederation, we hope to say more. Okay. 5 years later, Zabibia had passed from the scene, but around 733 BC, we see the annals again reporting on the Arabs. This time, because the new Arab queen, whose name was Samsi, based on the Semitic term for sun, Shamash in Akkadian, Shams in Arabic, had dared to defy Tiglath-Pileser III. We read of the outcome of such foolishness. Samsi, the queen of Arabia, who acted against the oath of Shamash, became afraid of my mighty army and sent to me camels and camel mares. I put an official regent over her. The inhabitants of Massa, Tema, Saba, is anywhere from here down to here, Chayapa, Badana, and Chati, in the tribe of the Idbailians, whose countries are far away towards the west, heard the fame of my rule and brought without exception all their tribute, gold, silver, male and female camels, and all kinds of spices. They came and kissed my feet. I established a palace as befitting of my position as their king in, and the place unfortunately is lost, and appointed Idbi'ilu as governor over the country, and the word is Musk, is it, if you know Arabic, means Egypt. In this context, it's probably right in here. In parallel accounts, we find that to instill this fear of Assyria in the Arabs, Tiglath-Pileser had to kill 1,000 inhabitants and 30,000 camels under Samsi's rule, and she herself had fled like as he says, a donkey mare to Bazu, a place of thirst. Location of Bazu is problematic, maybe down here, the Nuzel, 19th century, 20th century explorer puts it right up in here. She, as noted earlier, came to her senses. Perhaps even more interesting than the account of Sansi is the reference to the Idba'ilians. Reading from a foundation inscription coming from the period that fills in some more information lacking in the article above, we find that Idba'ilu is installed as warden of the marches, or warden of the gate, on the border of Egypt. We know from other sources that the settlements of district governors were called palaces, and doubtless this was what Tiglath-Pileser had in mind in the above comment. He had established a gubernatorial residence for the Idba'ilians on the frontier of Egypt. We pause for a second. Should we consider these Arabs as insignificant entities on the historical carta of the ancient Near East? While Gaza, Ammon, Moab, and Edom are busy sending tribute of gold, silver, tin, iron, antimony, linen, wool, horses, and mules to Assyria, and Samsi is sending camels, should we ignore the fact that the Arabs at the same time have been given recognition to the extent that one group is set up as governor on the border of Egypt? It's hardly premature, I would think, to say that we cannot write off Arabia as a no man's land in the period, and hardly premature to notice that the major powers were taking note of the